It's Friday, June 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the world's top oil producer is the United States, and we delve into what this means amid low prices and a glut of supply. The U.S. government grapples with an unprecedented cyber attack that has left millions of its employees vulnerable.
Both of these organizations, the Shia militias and ISIS, are organizations that need to be shunned.
U.S. sends troops to Iraq. Also ahead, hip-hop defined, remembered, and revived on film. And your reaction on social media to the passing of a revered actor. It's all next on International Edition. The United States has become the world's largest oil producer in 2014, that according to a report by the BP Energy Company. BP economist Spencer Dale credits the shale revolution for a surge in American oil production that helped U.S. producers leapfrog over Saudi Arabia. American output of natural gas and oil combined is now greater than that of Russia, the previous global leader. The U.S. now spends far less on energy imports, which once hurt the nation's balance of trade and the economy. VOA Economics correspondent Jim Randall discusses this amazing shift in our studios with David Byrd.
There was a time in our not-too-distant past when, if you thought of the largest oil producer in the world, you might have thought of Saudi Arabia, maybe Bahrain, somebody like that. But now, it turns out the United States has taken over the number one slot. That's according to a report by BP Energy. To discuss this, VOA's Jim Randall joins us in the studio. Jim, how does this affect the U.S. economy now that we're number one in oil production?
Well, as we produce more oil, we import less. And if we import less, that means we export fewer tens of billions of dollars. And that helps the U.S. balance of trade. That helps everything about the U.S. economy. So it's much less of a drag on the U.S. economy. It's sort of pro-growth.
Now, this economist, Spencer Dale, credits what's called the shale revolution, the fracturing of shale that has oil in it and bringing that oil up out of the ground for this. Is that affecting the demand for oil, and how is the demand for oil growing?
Well, the shale revolution is producing oil from fields that were played out and from fields that seemed uneconomic. So it's producing a lot more oil and a lot more natural gas. And that has tended to push prices down. Lower prices tends to increase demand for the product.
But fossil fuels like oil and coal and other things produce a lot of what are known as greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide. What is happening with CO2 emissions?
It appears that the global economy is becoming more efficient at using energy, and we're producing more unit of GDP, more widgets, more corn, more whatever per unit of oil. And so greenhouse gases have grown more slowly than they have in quite a while, expanding, I think, is 0.5% this last year, which is less than usual.
VOA Economics correspondent Jim Randall. The production surge comes as energy demand grew less than 1%. That's the weakest rate since 2009. BP experts calculate that weak demand and changes in Chinese energy use combined to keep growth in carbon emissions about 0.5% for the year. And while energy supplies outpaced demand, prices fell sharply. That allowed consumers to save money for other purposes, a change that eventually expected to boost economic growth. Well, we've been checking the trends on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and with me in the studio is our own Michael Lippin. Michael, we are mourning the loss of a revered actor today.
Hi, Jim. We are. It's kind of the end of an era. There's been an enormous amount of chatter about Christopher Lee on Twitter. The British actor's family revealed today that he died on Sunday of natural causes at the age of 93. Now, Lee was a prolific film actor whose career spanned more than half a century, and he was admired around the world for playing some of cinema's best-known villains, starting with Count Dracula and Frankenstein in the 1950s. Now, much later on, he won a new generation of fans as the evil wizard Saruman in the Lord of the Rings trilogy in the early 2000s. In that same period, he also starred in the Star Wars prequels, Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, as the evil Jedi Count Dooku. With a resume like that, you could expect a big reaction on Twitter to his passing, and that's exactly what we got. Mm-hmm. Analytics website Topsy shows that at least 500,000 Christopher Lee tweets have been posted in the past 24 hours. That's an average of almost 6 per second. If you'd like to post your own tribute to the actor on Twitter, you might consider using the hashtag Christopher Lee, that's all one word. That hashtag also has been pretty popular, being mentioned in almost 50,000 tweets so far today.
Oh, wow, some huge numbers out there. Well, what kinds of things have people been saying about Christopher Lee?
Well, tributes have been pouring in from the world of entertainment. The official James Bond Twitter account, that's at 007, said this: "We are very sad to hear that Sir Christopher Lee, who played one of Bond's greatest villains, has passed away. Our thoughts are with his family." Now, that Bond villain was Scaramanga, who faced off against Roger Moore as James Bond in the 1974 film The Man with the Golden Gun. That film came out before I was born. And here's a tweet from a prominent film critic, Scott Weinberg, who has 36,000 Twitter followers. "Do you have kids? They know who Christopher Lee is. Are your grandparents still around? So do they. That's amazing. Such a cool guy, too." Now, that tweet's obviously a reflection of how Christopher Lee entertained several generations of movie fans throughout his very, very long career. So, Jim, where would you put yourself in that timeline of film fans?
Well, I was born a little before you, and in fact, I saw the original Star Wars in the theater, so that gives you an idea. James Bond and Man with a Golden Gun, Scaramanga, is probably my favorite.
Great to hear.
Michael Lippin, thanks for dropping by. Follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
And this is VOA's International Edition. Cybersecurity is the topic among many of U.S. government officials right now following revelations of a massive hack that compromised about 4 million employee records. VOA's Doug Bernard has been hacking into the story for us. Doug, tell me more.
We've been following it for a while, and this is obviously still evolving as the investigation is continuing. The first thing that I'm going to say is the thing I think that every reporter should say. I think it's clear that the U.S. investigators know more about this hack, how it happened, and who may be behind it than they're saying. But think about this. When you're conducting a police investigation, the police don't come out and say, well, here's everything that we know.
Right.
So the things that we do know at this point, the U.S. government is saying that the hack appears to have originated from within China. They haven't yet pointed the finger directly at the government in Beijing, but there seems to be a growing, an accretion of stories and evidence and leaks that increasingly put it that direction. Mm-hmm. I think some analysts we've spoken with as well say, you know, when thinking about who's behind it, you want to ask yourself, what were the hackers trying to do? If you're trying to hack Target department store, for example, and get people's credit card numbers, well, that's clearly just cyber fraud. That's probably organized crime. Those are very basic kinds of things. Those kinds of things tend to originate in Russia and Ukraine. These were going after personnel records. And think about the information that's in there. There's no doubt lots of people within the U.S. government who have dealings with China, mm-hmm. who have various activities. There's all kinds of back and forth there. Well, potentially, a lot of private information about those people may now be in the hands of potentially, allegedly, some people in Beijing and maybe even the government.
And plus, if you can zero in on those people who have different levels of security clearances,
that's exactly right.
Then you know potentially who you can target specifically to perhaps glean some information that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get.
And the very fact that this looks increasingly like an act of espionage suggests that a state actor was at least in some ways involved in this.
This isn't the first time that we've had kind of a brush against China in terms of cyber espionage, and we have raised the concerns many times through meetings at all different levels of government, all
That's
the way
right.
up to the two presidents meeting.
That's right.
And yet this comes out again. It seems like we don't have too much influence at this moment.
Well, you know, there's several ways to look at this. Of course, President Obama's getting ready for the Chinese leader to come here in the fall. That meeting is still on track.
Mm-hmm.
There are conflicts like the Spratly Islands and other things, tensions between the two nations. One analyst I spoke with suggested, you know, look, this might just be Beijing, if Beijing is behind this, potentially just seeing how far they can push things just a little bit, just seeing where that line may be, at least in terms of cyber, until the U.S. pushes back. The U.S. response so far has been cautious, but if there is credible evidence that Beijing was behind this, I think we will definitely see some sort of pushback. It could be cyber, it could be economic, it could be political. We don't know.
Doug Bernard follows a variety of things for us here at VOA, and you'll want to go to our website, voanews.com, look up his column. It's right there
okay.
on the front page.
There you go.
And he'll tell you so much more about cybersecurity. Doug, thanks so much for stopping by.
Great to be here.
This is VOA's International Edition. As threats escalate in Iraq, the United States is sending 450 U.S. troops to set up a training base in Anbar province to backstop Iraqi forces and bring in Sunni tribes in that governorate. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Richard Brennan of the RAND Corporation if that deployment is enough.
Well, I think that 450 is going to be woefully inadequate to do the type of training and advising assisting that's necessary. And it's important to remember that of that 450, probably no more than 125 or 150 will be doing the training. The remainder of those troops will be used for securing the U.S. forces, for outreach to the Sunni, for providing logistics and maintenance support for the U.S. forces. So only a very small number of those will be used for training.
What about these training bases in Anbar? Obviously, this is to include Sunni tribes. Do we think that we can get these people to fight on the side of Baghdad?
Well, the training base that they're looking at establishing is Al-Takanam Iraqi base, which is located just east of Ramadi by about 20 miles. That's the same base where the United States military trained and used as outreach for the Sunni tribes in Anbar province during the Awakening Movement of 2006 and 2007.
The government of Iraq has enlisted the support of Shia militia. We have the Kurdish Peshmerga that are fighting. Now, we're setting up bases, and we're going to be advising, but it's only for GOI forces, for the actual Iraqi army. What about the rest of these people?
Well, the rest of these people, you talked about the Peshmerga. They conduct operations virtually autonomously from the central government, and the United States provides support for them. But more alarming is the Shia militias that have been doing independent operations, conducting activities independent of the central government. And the United States trying to bring all these organizations together, working for the government so you can have central command and control with mixed results.
Normally, wars are fought and wars are won by unified command, a singular decision base. This doesn't seem to be the case in Iraq. And how do you win when you don't have unified command?
That's a great point, and you can't win without unified command. And that's exactly what ISIS is exploiting today, is the fact that you've got the Sunnis who are fighting independently. They fear the Shia coming into their town, especially the Shia militias, who have a long-standing history of atrocities. If you go back to the 2004 and 5 time period, where you had the predecessor of ISIS, Al Qaeda in Iraq, who would cut the heads off of the Shia. Well, these Shia militias were doing just as equally violent activities by drilling holes in their enemy, the heads of their enemies. So both of these organizations, the Shia militias and ISIS, are organizations that need to be shunned, and it's alarming that the government of Iraq has such a close relationship with them today.
The U.S. plans to deploy the new advisors within 6 to 8 weeks, but President Barack Obama has ruled out sending in American ground troops. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Coming up on The Voice of America, English teaching and learning English. We begin with our English teaching programs, New Dynamic English and Functioning in Business. At half past the hour Universal Time, you'll hear the Learning English programs As It Is, Words and Their Stories, and People in America. Thank you for listening to VOA.
A defining moment in hip-hop music is now nearly 3 decades old, but it's been revived with a fresh cinematic twist, as David Byrd and Shauna Renee have stopped by our studios to discuss.
It has been 27 years since N.W.A.'s album Straight Outta Compton revolutionized hip-hop. Now a new movie aims to portray that time and the members of the group. To talk about this, Shauna Renee joins me in the studio. Shauna, thank you for being with me.
As always, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, N.W.A. was responsible for really a revolution in hip-hop. I mean, they brought that really raw street sound into the main mix, did they not?
Into the mainstream, absolutely. Up until that point, up until around 1988, 1989, hip-hop music existed primarily on the East Coast, number one. There was a West Coast music industry, hip-hop culture, but it wasn't as prominent or popular or well-known as what was going on in the East Coast. Also, at that time, hip-hop was a party music. It was, you know, what you played at the barbecues, and you danced, and you had a great time, and it was about, you know, life may be hard, but we're still trying to make it. Then out of nowhere, N.W.A. comes and says, hold on, wait a minute. Life isn't as good as they're saying it is. Not for us here in Los Angeles, where we're dealing with a whole lot of issues, including drugs and crime and police brutality and all of that. So it was those stories that revolutionized the way most young people saw hip-hop as a tool for expression and storytelling.
Now, this movie portrays the lives of all the people in N.W.A., the folks that people might recognize immediately, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, but it's the whole crew that's portrayed.
Right. DJ Yella and MC Ren are also portrayed. And it tells the story of how each of the members came together to form the group. And then it also goes on to tell the story of how the group eventually disbanded. They do spend some time with Eazy-E's life and also his death. And so this movie is actually very is very interesting and very important in that there are a lot of stories that a lot of things that happened within that group, stories that are speculative or rumored to be true or not, that I think, according to Ice Cube at least, will be cleared up.
I understand that Ice Cube's son was going to play him in the movie and Eazy-E's son was going to play him in the movie.
Yeah,
work out?
That didn't work out as well. There was a lot of speculation, too, about who would be directing the movie, who would be producing it. At first, we thought John Singleton would be directing the movie, which I thought would have been
a natural.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, F. Gary Gray directed the movie, which is going to be released in August. And he's done Friday. He worked with Ice Cube on Friday and Set It Off. And he's done a number of music videos for Ice Cube and Queen Latifah and Outkast. So he knows the hip hop culture just as well, if not, you know, better than John Singleton.
Now, this movie is not necessarily for kids, though. This has got an R rating, definitely for language and violence.
Well, there's nothing about NWA that was for kids.
That
ever.
Was PG.
That was, yeah. So, yeah, no surprise. This is not for kids. And in fact, you know, NWA was one of the groups that is responsible for why we have those stickers and labels on music that say parental advisory, explicit lyrics.
Well, we're looking forward to it. You know, we would love to know your opinion about NWA. We'd also love to hear from you. If you're on Twitter, you can hit up Shauna at VOA underscore music. She's also the hostess of the Soul Lounge. You can find her at www.voanews.com. Shauna, thank you.
Thank you so much. That's the way it goes.
You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. You've been listening to International Edition, and we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Stopping the recruitment of foreign terrorist fighters is a key concern for the global coalition to counter ISIL. General John Allen, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL, stressed this point in his speech to the Brookings Doha U.S. Islamic World Forum. He noted that comprehensive approaches to reduce the foreign terrorist fighter flow must start at the point of radicalization. Last year's United Nations Security Council Resolution 2178 calls on all nations to strengthen their borders, share information, and adjust their laws to criminalize traveling for terrorism. More than 30 partners have now made legal and justice reforms intended to make it more difficult to travel to the battlefront. Increasingly, as a result of the Internet, it is no longer necessary for foreign terrorist fighters to leave their home countries to be radicalized and recruited. This phenomenon has opened the door to radicalized individuals to conduct terrorist attacks in their home countries. Lone offender attackers, as they have become known, are a growing concern. That is why all nations need to work together at every link along the chain, at every border between a potential foreign terrorist fighter and the battle space, in their home communities, and at the point of recruitment and radicalization. The coalition's Foreign Terrorist Fighter Working Group is organizing coalition action around 9 fronts, ranging from border control to information sharing to mapping travel to improving legal capabilities and post-counteroffensive foreign terrorist fighter flows. ISIL is practiced in exploiting a sense of rootlessness and separation that many young people feel in their communities, whether in minority communities in the West, in certain Arab societies, or in Southeast Asia. A feeling of disenfranchisement and otherness is present and powerful for many, said General Allen. There is also separation between the opportunities young people see on their smartphones and those they believe are available to them in their own lives. We must guard against the manipulation of these separations and anxieties, said General Allen, while at the same time working to address their root causes. Stopping the flow of foreign terrorist fighters is critical to winning the fight against ISIL. Through strength and unity of purpose, ISIL can and will be defeated.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.